Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
MSW Media.
Hey, it's Kimberly, host of the Start Me Up podcast. If you like your politics with some loose talk and salty language, you're going to love my show. I interview the coolest people like Mary Trump, Kathy Griffin, and DNC chair Jamie Harrison. The Start Me Up podcast has an easygoing, casual style and a strong emphasis on left-leaning politics. We also have frank discussions about sex and more than a few spirited rants. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup or wherever you get your podcasts and start listening today.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans. One rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich, and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 13 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. I'm AG, and with me, as always,
Andrew Torres. And we are leaning hard into episode 13. None of this skipping from 12 to 14 for us and pretending like there's a floor that doesn't exist. No, no. This is episode 13. Strap in and like it.
It's like the good old Mitch Hedberg joke. People, you know, they don't have 13 floors in hotels, but people on the 14th floor, you know what floor you're really on. If you jump out the window, you will die earlier. All right. So thank you, by the way, to this week's new patrons, Emily Trapp, Dari Smith, Paula Peffer, and Jeff Schaefer. And take it away, Andrew, for what is definitely, only coincidentally, the 3 most ridiculous names on the list.
Yeah. Thank you to Hotspur's Ode to a Small Lump of Filibuster I Found in My Armpit One Midsummer Morning. That's an excellent mashup. It's really, really good. And thanks, Hotspur. Thanks to Nope. Love that. And thanks to Why Aren't We Calling the January 6th Insurrection an Act of Treason? Which, you know, we definitely are. Anyway, these kind folks signed up at patreon.com/aisle45pod and gave us literally as little as one American dollar.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And if you're a patron, then last Saturday you got the chance to play pub trivia against Team Awesome. Ooh. That is you and me. And we did pretty well. We came in a close second, 1 point behind the team called Trivia Newton John.
That was so much fun. I can't wait to do it again. If you are a patron at any level, the video of the actual trivia is up. So if you want to watch your fellow Aisle 45ites play, you can do that. What did not make it? What is, I think, like just not preserved for eternity? I stuck around for like an hour and a half in the chat, just like answering questions, bullshitting. It was a lot of fun. I meant to do like, you know, two or three. I had a lot of stuff going on, but it was like, it was so much fun. We did kind of an impromptu Q&A. Jen was the ringmaster or, you know, whatever. And we had a ton of fun. So we will definitely be doing, right, as we're sort of figuring out how to best get patrons what they want, like these kind of monthly hangouts, whether it's to play trivia or to, you know, answer questions or to just goof off, like that's been a lot of fun, and can't wait to do it again. So that's our last plug, patreon.com/aisle45pod. If you haven't signed up, you're literally stealing this show. No. But we'll give you, it's always a free show. We know you have a lot of, you know, college students, single moms, you know, that sort of thing. But if you can help us out.
Yes. And there were some really interesting stories that have happened over the past week. Of course, we've been watching the Derek Chauvin trial.
Yep.
We've had a string of police officers testify in favor of the prosecution. I've never seen anything like that. Just officer after officer after officer, and then trainer, lieutenant, and the chief, all coming in that just to break that blue wall of silence we so often see in these kinds of situations, in these trials where there is a police officer on trial. It was very noteworthy to me.
Yeah, it was really encouraging. Also encouraging were the expert medical testimony, which I think, look, If we had an hour, I could get into, right, the way in which the defense strategy is going to try and drive a wedge between the experts. That there's always a little bit of sort of lack of convergence. But I don't want to lose sight of the overall picture, which is my views have not changed from the beginning. Are there things that I would nitpick about any lawyer? Sure, right, because that's what lawyers do. This, you know, kind of goes back to your comments on the prosecution's opening statements, right? Like there are things that could have been done differently. But in general, the prosecution is putting on a very, very good case. I think it is going to be a challenge looking at, you know, prior cases and, you know, and what I keep in the back of my head is the OJ trial, right? By this point in the OJ trial, everybody knew what the one single coherent theory of the defense was, right? It was cops in LA are racist and they falsify evidence. And yeah, maybe OJ is guilty, but if the cops framed a guilty man here, then you have no choice but to acquit him, mm-hmm. right?
Yep, I remember it clearly.
That was very clearly the underlying argument. I defy you to articulate what the underlying argument is here. It has been a grab bag of racist bullshit, and that's it.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that sort of became clear at first where it seemed like, especially in the opening statements, they were going to really harp on the fact that there was this angry, distracting mob of onlookers. And it's like a 9-year-old and a 16-year-old, the ex-MMA guy, an off-duty EMT firefighter, you know, and they've all testified and they've all been extremely potent witnesses. But the other thing I thought was interesting is when they had the medical examiners come up, they kept trying to talk about the fentanyl
yeah.
in his system. And I thought one of the really, really important pieces of redirect was, you know, the prosecutors asked questions of this one doctor, a pulmonologist, I think. And then the defense cross-examined and was like, yeah, but fentanyl can cause death. Yes, fentanyl and overdoses on fentanyl, et cetera. And just sort of a weird, nothing really coherent about that particular cross-exam. And then so finally, prosecution gets back up on redirect and says, all right, look, you can die from fentanyl, right? And when you die from fentanyl, there's a coma that happens before that, right? Always? Yes, always a coma. And at any point, was George Floyd ever in a coma? No. Okay, thank you. And he went back and sat back down. And then, of course, there was that slide where they brought up where they started doing ratios of the fentanyl and then what fentanyl breaks down into as it metabolizes. And his ratio, George Floyd's ratio, was 1.96 of fentanyl to the metabolized fentanyl. And then they did because this lab is so huge, he was able to put together other statistics to show all of the other deaths that he looked at with fentanyl in the system. That ratio was 9.06. Then he also did DUI cases where fentanyl was involved, and those people were still alive. And their fentanyl ratio to the metabolized fentanyl was 3.09 or something like that. Still almost twice what George Floyd's level was. So it was a very, very powerful slide. And, you know, I understand a lot of people are like, why do we even have to do this? The video is the video. And it's like, yep, but what the defense is going to do is they're going to try to put a seed of reasonable doubt in anybody's head. And it is the prosecution's job to erase that little bit of reasonable doubt that could creep in. And I think they did a really excellent job so far.
100%. And look, every lawyer will tell you, right? I don't do criminal cases. I do civil cases. You do the same thing. You frontline your witnesses in terms of where their weak spots are. Because if you don't, then the impression that the jury gets is that you as the prosecution didn't know that. Right. And so if they went through and pretended like, oh, you know, there's never been a history of drug use here. Right. He had no drugs in his system. Then, like, the second the defense gets up and puts on their first witness, all of a sudden the jury is going to say, well, if they didn't tell us about the fentanyl in his system, what else did they tell us about? Right.
Right.
It,
yeah.
It wrecks your credibility. And so what you do is exactly what you do here. And I do kind of understand it shouldn't matter, but this is why it matters. It matters because you are making a lengthy, multi-week presentation in which you are asking the jurors to trust you that the story you are telling is correct and that the witnesses you've put up are not lying. And part of the way in which you do that is by painting as accurate a picture as you can, warts and all. So that dovetails nicely with what I wanted to talk about that happened today and will likely continue tomorrow as of this recording. And that is, if you're watching this trial, you get to see a thing that you will not see in any other criminal trial, in any other murder trial anywhere in the country. And I don't know whether you should be seeing it. It is a subset of testimony called Spark of Life testimony. And the reason it's called Spark of Life testimony, which is a very stupid thing to call it, is because Minnesota is the only state that permits this kind of testimony. None of the rest do. And that was the language that the Minnesota Supreme Court used in 1985 when, perhaps what might be seen as an ironic twist, the victim in that case was a police officer. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said, yes, you can introduce testimony that shows that he is, quote, imbued with the spark of life and a human being and not just sort of a rote statistic. Now, let me explain why that's significant. Every state allows, to some degree, victim impact testimony, right? But that comes out after you've decided, it comes out in the sentencing phase, right? It comes out after you've decided guilt or innocence, because whether the victim was a good guy, a bad guy, or something in between is absolutely not relevant, right? Like, from a legal perspective, bears nothing on the question of whether the accused defendant did it or not, right? And that's why 49 states do not allow you to introduce this kind of testimony. Minnesota does. But you have to be very, very careful. So, for example, we've talked about this before. The federal rules of evidence, as mimicked in the states and at play here, exclude testimony that is unduly prejudicial, even if it is somewhat probative, right? So, for example, there have been motions in limine in which the prosecution has kept out certain pieces of evidence that are character evidence, including a conviction for armed robbery from 2007, right? And they should, right? And the reason you do that is not because it is not relevant at all to the instant case, right? It is the fact that somebody has previously committed a violent felony is slightly more informative in an issue in which, you know, that the Derek Chauvin is saying, we were terrified for our lives, you know, that sort of thing, which is obviously bullshit. It's slightly more relevant, but it's way more prejudicial than it is relevant, right? So the judge has kept that out, and correctly so. And let's be clear, right? If the judge had allowed that in, that would have been atrocious, right? Like that kind of evidence, one-off prior criminal offense that's hugely prejudicial, never ever comes in, particularly when you're talking about the crime, you know, the victim of the crime here, right? But now, suppose you put on spark of life evidence, right? And you say George Floyd was never violent with anyone, right? He was always composed. He never, right? Yeah, at that point, you run the risk, and I've looked through Minnesota case law, right? Like, this is where this issue gets litigated.
Is this where you open the door to...
Exactly right. And then on cross-examination, right, despite there being a motion in limine, the defense counsel gets up and says, okay, Mr. Witness, you've testified that George Floyd was... never violent. Are you aware, right? And then you introduce the evidence. Then there's immediately an objection. But the ability to ask that question, right, poisons to some extent the jury pool, right? Like they now hear about this thing, and even though they're instructed to disregard it, and we've talked about like deliberation, buy-in among the jurors, you can't unring the bell. It's hard to unhear it.
Yeah. So this is where we hear those common phrases we see in all the movies. You opened the door, counselor, yep. And yes, but you can't unring the bell and strike it from the record. And no.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. All those things come out. So my point is just that this is an area where I would tread very, very carefully. And so far, right, the first day of Spark of Life testimony, that's what we've seen, right? We've seen, sort of at the most basic, trying to humanize George Floyd, which he is a human. He is a real victim. He deserves to be humanized. In most states, you don't do it this way. In most states, this comes in the victim impact phase, which in my view is kind of where it belongs. So, I'm not a prosecutor in Minnesota. To me, the danger is very, very high when you when you sort of go down the character path, and it's not one that I know that they needed, but it shows you, right, at the end of the day, right, that the prosecution is availing itself of every argument that is available in order to move this case forward.
Mm-hmm. And Minnesota is the only state, and they don't do this federally either, correct?
Nope.
So when you see it in the movies, it's probably a lie.
It just definitely is. Well, think about it. It just, logically speaking, who the victim was bears bears nothing in terms of whether the defendant committed the crime. So
no, and we saw this all throughout the Mueller investigation. It wasn't until the sentencing when Manafort's wife, who hated him, didn't really show up to say, he's a really great guy, please go easy on him. It's those character witnesses, so to speak, don't really come out until the sentencing phase.
Oh, so Manafort's wife. That is such an A-plus callback.
Well, you remember all the stuff that the daughter... Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I do have... We'll continue to cover this trial. It's going to be really interesting to see the rest of that Spark of Life testimony and how lightly they tread and how they navigate it. But I did, before we go to break, wanted to bring in a little a joy to this program. And, I've been following the Matt Gaetz gate, Milkshake Matt, quite closely. And a couple of stories, I think the big ones that have broken, I'm not going to go into all the details, all the details, but I think the big ones that have broken are, first of all, the Venmo payments, which just cracks me up.
Yeah.
I I don't know, man. I don't know. He apparently paid $900 via Venmo publicly to Greenberg. Greenberg then publicly distributed those funds to three women, one who had just turned 18 6 months prior, according to court documents, at least. Not court documents, just sleuthing, just online sleuthing, right? I still have questions about these ID cards that they were parsing in the middle of the night, 400 miles away from Matt's home. And they have video of it. But and then Greenberg pays these out to these women and puts memos for tuition and schooling in the memos. So that story broke. Then, of course, we've got the story that Trump declined a meeting with Gates. And Gates added himself to that Doral speaking engagement just days before
it
happened.
Right.
And Trump aides told the press, yeah, we think he's just down here trying to accidentally bump into Donald Trump is what we think is happening. But Jason Miller, a spokesperson for Trump, an absolute douchebag, said, no, he never asked. Trump said Gates never asked for a meeting, so therefore we could have never denied one. It's like, okay, thank you for that Perry Mason moment of how time works. It just really not a good. Here's the thing: despite the pardon not happening, the meeting not happening, Gates is being hung out to dry, left high and dry by this Trump administration after he bootlicked it for so long. And it's just interesting to watch.
Why is anybody surprised by this? Right? Like in his entire wretched, miserable life, has Donald Trump ever done anything for anybody who was not immediate family or circle of cronies? Right?
Well, like, he was a circle of crony. And here's the thing. Like, he mentioned when Trump got up and spoke at some bullshit thing this weekend. He's
still like fresh in his, you know, unwashed golf shirt and the like hat pulled down over his eyes that would have gotten me kicked out of any class in college. Right. Like,
yeah. But he named Jim Jordan and Kristi Noem and like he went through some Republican supporters. But Gates was conspicuously omitted from that list. So.
Yeah. No. I am delighting in this story. I am delighting in watching the inevitable fall of Matt Gaetz. And also, like, I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on, although I have a pretty good idea if you're listening to the show at the moment. Now is not a great time to engage in the philosophical questioning over what should count as statutory rape. Okay. So how about like the Glenn Greenwalds of the world, like back the fuck off for a while. And look, I would be saying that regardless of whether the target was somebody I am delighted to see go down or would hate to see go down. Let's not.
Didn't Greenwald tweet like, well, in such and such state, 16 is the age of consent. And in this state, 17 is the age of consent. And I'm like, how do you know that? Why do you know that?
Yeah. That was real weird knowledge to have at your fingertips. Yeah.
Well, we have some really, really great news about a new SCOTUS commission coming up. We're going to talk about that in the next block. We've got a lot of other cleanup stuff. We're going to do the D block. We've got a lot of new hirings happening, particularly DHS, Customs and Border Patrol. It's going to be a great show, a lot of information. We still have a lot to get to, but we do need to take a quick break. So stick around. We'll be right back with information on the new SCOTUS Commission. Hey, everybody. Today's episode of Cleanup on Aisle 45 is brought to you by the most useful app on my phone. It's my new favorite life hack. It's called Blinkist. Sometimes finding the time to read or work on professional development can be tricky when you're super busy, but Blinkist is designed to solve this problem. Blinkist is a unique app that works on your phone, tablet, or web browser. It takes the best key takeaways, that need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down to just 15 minutes. You can read or listen to, you know, anywhere you are. Most successful people are known to be voracious readers, and Blinkist makes it possible for busy people who want to get the main points of a book quickly and start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book while driving or working out. 12 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library from self-help, business, health, and history books. Blinkist has the latest titles from bestsellers, and it has the classic nonfiction titles you always meant to read but never had time to. I like Blinkist for me personally because in less than 15 minutes, I get the main points of a book, and that helps me evaluate which books I want to read in full later. I've recently read Everything Trump Touches Dies by Rick Wilson, ETTD. Pretty accurate title. It's great. And with Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all the books you want, and all for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for just our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/cleanup, try it free for 7 days, and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/cleanup. Cleanup is all one word. Start your free 7-day trial, and you'll save 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/cleanup.
And welcome back. We are revisiting a story from episode 3 in which President Biden announced that he was forming a bipartisan committee on reforming the Supreme Court, one over which I expressed some disappointment with the initial press release, if you might recall, Allison.
Yeah, and I know, like, we were putting the show together today, and I'm like, I'm going to write up the SCOTUS thing, and the thing, and you're like, no.
Nope.
Nope. I want to write up the SCOTUS thing, because I was like, yep, you're right. I remember we were talking about Jack Goldsmith was said to be one of the co-chairs of this committee, and take it away, because you, this is your baby.
Yeah, okay. So, when we first covered it, the leak was Goldsmith and Bob Bauer were going to be the two co-chairs. And Goldsmith is a hardcore right-wing originalist, right? Member of the Federalist Society, outspoken cheerleader for what the Federalist Society has done, right? And the role that they played in basically taking command of the entire judicial nomination process under Trump. He supported Gorsuch. He supported Kavanaugh. He went out of his way. He wrote a separate letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee about how qualified Amy Coney Barrett was.
And you know, I mean, am I wrong here thinking that those are the reasons we need reform at the Supreme Court in the first place? Like, so what's the latest? What is the good news here?
Yeah. So, yes, you're correct. Last Friday, Biden formally promulgated the executive order that established this presidential commission. It has up to 36 members, which has not been filled out yet, two co-chairs, and Goldsmith is on the committee, but he's not one of the chairs.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, we knew longstanding Biden lawyer Bob Bauer was going to be one of the co-chairs, blah, blah, blah. But on Friday, it was announced that the other co-chair will be Yale law professor Christina Rodriguez. She's Latina. She's 48. She was on Biden's transition team. Her specialty seems to be immigration law. I take it you think she's a probably better choice than Goldsmith?
I do. Rodriguez is very, very smart. Her work demands serious engagement. But it might be slightly different than you would think just from like hearing that bio, right? Like, she just published a book called The President and Immigration Law. It is actually a continuation of work that she began back in 2009, right? So she wrote a law review article, 90 pages back in 2009, expanded it out to a book. I've read the law review article. I've read excerpts of the book. It's very, very scholarly. But at the end of the day, Rodriguez's argument is that the major disconnect on immigration law is what she calls an asymmetry. She says Congress is the branch that has wide discretion over the admission of immigrants, right, setting policy, while the president has wide discretion over enforcement and deportation. So you have this unequal kind of push and pull dynamic.
Ah, so, but I mean, unequal, they're co-equal branches of government, but what, it feels unequal? And yeah. I mean, is the solution to curtail the president's power over deportation?
That'd be a real good suggestion. Rodriguez considers that and says, well, that's not super likely. So therefore, and I think she knows she's got a heavy lift here. And again, remember, she pitched this in 2009 before we could really imagine a Donald Trump as president. But it is an argument in favor of vastly expanding the power that Congress delegates to the president regarding admission of immigrants. So, look, I think that this is intellectually defensible. Feels pretty tone deaf in 2021.
Yeah. There's good news about this commission, though. I mean, I saw that Lawrence Tribe is on it. Yep. Tribe isn't just a genius. He's also a no-holds-barred, tell-it-like-it-is anti-Trumper. You know we love Lawrence Tribe. But there's other great things that this commission is doing and looking at. So what are some other good news pieces here?
Yep. You're right to point out Tribe. Ed Tribe has forgotten more about con law than I will ever know. He's exactly the kind of person that needs to be on this committee. Other people who deserve to be recognized, including a couple of folks that I'm glad I got a chance to do some deep dive on. Bertrall Ross, not somebody I knew before this announcement, is the chair of Berkeley's Diversity and Democracy Project. And he has written extensively on the intersection of constitutional law and the structural marginalization of poor and minority communities in the democratic process. Not a bomb thrower, super smart guy whose work really deserves recognition and voice. And I'm super happy to see him on this commission.
And I think my favorite name is Kermit Roosevelt. He's a Roosevelt and yep. He's Kermit. And he's articulated a pretty actually impressive anti-originalist theory of constitutional jurisprudence over the last decade and a half, right?
Yep,
Richard
yep.
Pildes cares about election law and gerrymandering and clerked for Thurgood Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
Sherrilyn Ifill, who I love, is on this commission.
Yeah, and look, like, so you're doing a great job at picking out the rock stars on the committee. And look, they're not a lot of poison pills. It's a bipartisan committee, but it certainly leans to the left.
Oh, good.
I was pretty shocked to see William Bode, the public apologist for originalism and the subject of the last two deep dives on opening arguments as to how wrong he is, on there. I just can't imagine what he's going to bring to the table.
Well, maybe nothing, but you got to have these other siders on there, right? I mean, it's like I've been talking about since Biden took over and was trying to get legislation passed, I've been talking about making Joe Manchin happy by appearing bipartisan, but actually inviting Republicans to the White House. We're going to have to invite the Republicans to the White House. We're going to have to sit down. They're going to have to tell us that they don't want anything close to what we want, and then we can move forward. We have to do that due process. And so I feel like that's kind of what's going on here, you know?
Well, and that's what I'm going to wait and see, right? Because to me, when you ask me to define what is it about the Supreme Court that needs reforming, what needs reforming is that over the past 20 years, when Republicans have controlled the White House, they've outsourced judicial nominations to the Federalist Society, including most notably on the Supreme Court, but like up and down the judiciary. And the Federalist Society is, I know our listeners don't need to hear this again, a narrow, partisan, right-wing, motivated cabal of activists that want to undo major segments of American government, right? So I see a couple of folks who are and I should say more than a couple, half dozen, who are vocal in their belief that that's a problem, right? Tribe, Ifill, Roosevelt. There's someone on there that I didn't know before, Guy Uriel Charles, who is about to become the first Ogletree professor at Harvard. I had Ogletree as a professor back in the day because I'm old. Those are really, really good signs. Little worrisome that we got two cheerleaders for the Federalist Society on there. But we'll see. And I guess the question is, will there be gatekeeping around, you know, the elephant in the room?
Mm. Yeah. And it's, you know, we need to see their sort of process for how policy is put in place. I'm assuming they just write reports
yeah.
for the president and then policy is decided. So, but I mean, if you truly wanted a bipartisan commission on judicial reform, this seems like it would be reflective since you've got those, but you know, people from both of those sides, members and cheerleaders for the Federalist Society and those loud rock star voices against it.
You do. And I'll go a step further, which is to say, you don't have any Justin Walkers on here, right? Like you don't have people that in my view are right unreachable, like, you know, unfit to communicate in civilized society, right? Like, I've invited, William Bode may come on my show, right? Like, it's he's somebody I'm happy to talk to. I'm happy to talk to Jack Goldsmith. I'm not going to, you know, pull any punches if I get a chance to talk to those guys. It's a little bit different. So I'm trying, AG. I'm trying.
Well, the list of topics that they're tasked with covering is very heartening, mm-hmm. because we've got the court's role in the constitutional system. Yep. The length and service and turnover of justices on the court, the membership and size of the court, ding, 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 size of the court, and the court's case selection rules and practices. So they aren't leaving anything off the table to be discussed here. And I think that that's really important, especially given that we've got some of those Federalist Society wonks over there, but that, you know, that we have these other incredible, powerful voices too, and they are allowed to be considering and discussing the size of the Supreme Court and whether there's term limits and turnover and age and stuff like that.
I agree with that 100%. I'm glad that that's, you know, sort of where we've come kind of full circle in terms of wrapping it up. And ultimately, if you have some of these moderate to Republican voices conceding on things that are facts, they're inconvenient facts if you are a member of the Federalist Society in a Biden administration. But for example, the entire judiciary from top to bottom is grotesquely overworked and overburdened. And if you can get a Jack Goldsmith to say that in his report, knowing that the implication of increasing spots on the Supreme Court means increasing picks that Joe Biden gets to make, then that adds a lot to the argument going forward. So I understand it. I see the risk and reward.
We'll see how it goes, and we will be following it. And I know that
indeed we will.
I know that you're gonna definitely have some details as they unfold. I'm very excited about this. It's time we look at this. It's past time.
Yeah,
we look
at absolutely.
It. All right. Next up, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to be talking about cleaning up one of the most egregious human rights violations of our time, which is the zero tolerance family separation policy at the border, and what Biden and the Biden administration, via executive order and through policy at Department of Homeland Security, is doing to correct this situation moving forward. So stick around. We're going to talk about that right after this break. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone. It's AG. We all know our health is the most valuable thing we have, especially now. Nowadays, we're all focused on our well-being, but I prefer to avoid being in a doctor's office right now. I think you do, too. Thankfully, there's a practical and affordable way to take control of your health and get personalized care from the comfort of your home. It's called SteadyMD. SteadyMD is your personal doctor online. You start by taking a quick quiz to get matched with a licensed primary care physician who understands your lifestyle and your health needs. Next, you have a one-hour appointment with your doctor to start a relationship. That's that intake appointment. After that, your doctor is available to you anytime by text, phone, or video chat. Unlike other services, this isn't a random doctor on call. Each SteadyMD doctor has a limited number of patients on their panels, so they have time to listen and give you personal attention that you deserve. I took the quiz, and I like that they matched me according to my individual health and lifestyle with a provider. SteadyMD can help you get and stay healthy, manage chronic conditions and concerns, reduce stress, lose weight, sleep better, feel better, boost your immunity, and much, much more, while still in the serenity of your home, so you can skip the waiting room and the germs. Prescriptions are sent directly to your home or local pharmacy, and you get unlimited access to your doctor for only $99 a month. No additional fees, visits, or copays. SteadyMD will help you understand and get the most out of your health insurance, but insurance is not required. SteadyMD is now accepting members of all ages in all 50 states. So go to steadymd.com/cleanup, take the free quiz, and see which doctor is perfect for you. That's SteadyMD, steadymd.com/cleanup. There's no risk, no long-term commitments. That's steadymd.com/cleanup. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. Everybody, welcome back. I'm AG. I'm here with Andrew Torres. We are about to talk about what I think is, and I said this before the break, one of the most egregious human rights violations of, like, just, I just, it's the stuff of terror horror movies, what's been going on with the zero tolerance policy under the former guy's administration, started by Jeff Sessions, who has now come out and said he feels bad about it. But about a week ago, NBC reported that Biden's Justice Department had a deadline to decide whether it would respond to requests by lawyers representing separated families for documents related to the former guy's zero tolerance policy. This is the ACLU case. The judge extended the deadline to April 9th last week, was the deadline. And now the judge has extended it to April 9th. And the materials include emails between top Trump administration officials and minutes of high level meetings during the planning of the policy, as well as, the Department of Justice Inspector General report on zero tolerance. They did that. So now they have to decide whether to hand that over. Now, at the time, the Trump administration cited executive privilege and didn't hand over shit, basically. And that's what they have to decide now.
Yeah. And that's the nice thing about the party remaining the same, but the folks staffing that party changing 180 degrees. So we have also learned that Biden's family separation task force has identified 5,600 files that are marked yet to be reviewed. Those are from the first half of 2017, right? So really, as soon as the policy was put into place, the thought process is that they may hold evidence of additional family separations, according to a senior official at DHS. Mm-hmm.
And these were the cases that while they were developing the zero tolerance policy, before it officially went into place, that's where they found these files from, right? That's kind of where these 5,600 unreviewed files, because, you know, you remember, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but there was a commission put together while Trump was in office to help reunite these families because there was a court fucking order to make it happen. And they ignored it and finally had to do something about it. But they only had documentation since the official beginning of the zero tolerance policy. But apparently this new Biden task force is the one that found these 5,600 files that have not yet been reviewed.
Yep.
About separated families that happened in that first half, that from the day Trump took office to about, I think, June or July.
Yeah. And you've touched on the two most important points, right? So this is in the discovery process, this ACLU suit, and there are a couple of parallel suits that have been brought by the ACLU. When you seek discovery, you say, policy went into effect August 1, 2017. So you'll say, produce all documents related to, you know, the policy from the date August 1, 2017 to the present. What Biden's task force independently developed, okay, so again, they didn't have to disclose this, or arguably they didn't. It's a civil lawsuit. They didn't have to disclose this. They said, by the way, looks like we have a department, right, the Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement, that has these 5,600 files that are dated from inauguration day, January 20th, through July of 2017. They may relate to family separations, even though they technically predate the policy. So mm-hmm. That's exactly correct.
And the date's important there because the any time predating the policy, early 2017, is apparently not included in the ACLU lawsuit. So that's why they don't have to produce these, right? But I guess approximately 2,800 families were separated during the administration's zero tolerance policy in mid-2018. Lawyers have said previously more than 1,000 others had been separated prior to the policy's official implementation. This official provided no timeline for reunification for still separated families, but said the Biden administration had entered into settlement negotiations with the ACLU in their lawsuit against the federal government over separations, but said that an initial report on the progress of the task force was due on June 2nd.
Yeah, and put a pin in that. We're going to talk about that at the end of the segment, because that's actually a separate parallel lawsuit. So in addition to the ACLU lawsuit, right, we have the steering committee lawsuit, right? Those are lawyers tasked with reuniting separated families. And they filed a document last Wednesday that's a status report saying that they had successfully contacted the parents of 61 more children. And so that drops our number down, and we're going to talk about these specific cases, but our present number of known separated children whose parents have yet to be contacted by the government to try and reunite these families is down from 506 to 445. Okay. So this committee, attorneys working pro bono, it's called the steering committee. They periodically update the court on their progress. They file a line with the court to the judge that is overseeing this entire process.
Yeah. And the month before, February, the committee brought the number from 611 to 506.
Right.
They found the parents of 105 children. They began their work under the Trump administration. They've continued their work while the Biden administration's Family Reunification Task Force builds its own database of potentially separated families. That's the task force we were talking about that identified the 5,600 yet to be reviewed files that came up before the process or the actual policy was implemented. But what do you think that is taking the initial steering committee so long?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of factors here. So look, the lawyers on the committee told the judge that the separations that occurred in 2017, which were right during this time period prior to the zero tolerance policy, have been particularly difficult to track down because the government didn't keep any contact information or records from that time period. So that may be present in those 5,600 files. Of these, so we're down to 445 individuals. The committee told the court that 302 have been deported to Central America. I wish that were more specific, but 302 have been deported. 129 have parents here in the United States, so presumably they can be contacted. And the remaining 14, we still don't know. But look, 14 is a manageable number. Right. Compared to 611.
Yeah. And then, of course, we have these 5,600 new files, but they haven't been really reviewed. Yeah. We don't yet know how many there are contact information for or how many, if any, have been deported. The Biden task force was created by executive order yep. on Biden's 13th day in office. The chair is Secretary of Homeland Security. The vice chairs are Secretary of State and the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And the Attorney General is also on this task force. And they're tasked with identifying, their job is to identify all the children separated from the day Trump took office to the day he left, January 20th, 2017, January 20th, 2021. Then their second charge is to reunify those families. And then their third charge is to, constantly brief Biden on their status. So while this other steering committee pro bono have been, you know, finding anywhere from 60 to 100 reuniting these kids with their parents every month of those that we know we have contact information for, this parallel task force is moving forward apropos of nothing other than just because we have to clean up this mess and it's the right thing to do, but you know, not being compelled by any lawsuits or anything like that, have just since they, you know, since the executive order, since they were formed, have found located 5,600 additional files.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm seeing. And the ACLU is asking the Biden administration now for documents refused by Trump because they've been looking for this in these lawsuits. This lawsuit, particularly I'm thinking of the ACLU lawsuit, for all documents and emails pertaining to the zero tolerance policy. And now Biden's in office, so they're re-asking. They're like, hey, Hap, will you give it to us? And again, I think they have until April 9th to decide whether they're going to do that. But do I have that right?
Yeah, you have all of that exactly right. And there's one more wrinkle to sort of layer on top of all of this, right? And that's another ACLU lawsuit that has sort of been thrust back out into the discussion here. So as I'm about to explain this, think about the sharp contrast of what we've discussed here, right? Like, it remains an you can criticize the Biden administration on some of its policies and some of its actions. It represents a radical departure from the last guy. But here's an area where the ACLU may resume their lawsuit. So once COVID hit a little over a year ago here in the United States, and we started to realize how serious it was, Trump took the position that the Public Health Service Act of 1944, which is found at Title 42 of the U.S. Code, also authorized the immediate expulsion of immigrants, adults and children, right? They called this the Title 42 immigration process. Spoiler, there is no Title 42 immigration process. And began summarily expelling immigrants at the border. That even applied to those who were seeking asylum, fleeing torture and persecution. Okay. The provision of the law that they are citing is 42 U.S.C. sections 265 and 268. Not going to read them to you because this segment's running long, but these are quarantine provisions. They're not immigration provisions. They don't have a goddamn thing to do with immigration. They empower the Surgeon General to set up quarantine protocols to prohibit the introduction of persons and property and avert the danger of communicable diseases from foreign countries. It 100% does not apply here, right? Like it says, oh, hey, you got a big boat of people with tuberculosis. You can stick them in a tent for 14 days. The Surgeon General can implement proper protocols. We can TB test them before you let them loose. It does not say you can turn and send refugees home to face political persecution. But, of course, that's how the Trump administration dealt with it. The ACLU sued immediately, June of 2020. After Biden promulgated his executive order, right, the one we've talked about, the ACLU agreed to stay this particular piece of litigation and negotiate in good faith, right? They said, look, seems like you don't want to be taking this ridiculous position on the Public Health Service Act of 1944, so we're going to stay the case until June and see if we can't reach a settlement. However, after President Biden's March 25th press conference, in which he said, quote, the border is closed and they're all going back, end of quote, ACLU attorney Lee Glernt entered his appearance, right? That's just you file a document that says, hey, I'm an attorney here to argue on behalf of the ACLU. Well, the only reason to do that, right, is if you're planning to reopen the litigation and move forward. So I've continued to check the docket. As of today's record, they have not moved to lift the stay, but that's what I'm looking for. I hope we can reach, you know, good faith accommodations here. But look, I am glad that the external forces that are working with the Biden administration are still going to hold the line on the Biden administration.
Yes, so. Very glad about that as well. All right. We've got comings and goings that we can discuss. We've got some new hires coming in, and it's going to be our D block, and which is seriously still one of my favorite parts of this show. But we're going to do that right after this quick break. So stick around. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody, it's AG for Cleanup on I-45, and it's time to tell you about my favorite thing in the world, Magic Spoon cereal. Incredibly delicious, super healthy cereal that brings joy to your mornings or afternoons or evenings or midnight snack times. My favorite food growing up was always cereal. I would plop down in front of Saturday morning cartoons and eat a whole bowl and then drink the delicious milk. But as an adult, I eat healthier. I'm trying to avoid carbs and sugar, so I had to give it up. But Magic Spoon saved me. It tastes exactly like regular cereal from your childhood, but it is super nutritious and good for you. Magic Spoon has amazingly 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. Plus, it's only got 140 calories per serving. It's deep breath. Keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. And, exciting news, Magic Spoon is releasing 2 amazing new flavors for a limited time only. We're talking about cookies and cream and maple waffle. And if that's not the most comforting, indulgent combination, I do not know what is. This is the ultimate treat-yourself combo, so make sure you get some while you can for a limited time, or build your own box. Available flavors to build your very own custom bundle are cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, and cinnamon. I love the great new flavors. Combining them is amazing, too. Cocoa and peanut butter together tastes exactly like a peanut butter cup. So go to magicspoon.com/cleanup to grab the new limited edition cookies and cream, maple waffle, or a custom bundle and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code CLEANUP, all one word, at checkout to save $5 off your order. This offer is now good anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, but only when you use our code at checkout. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, and so am I. It is backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they will refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/cleanup and use code CLEANUP to save $5 off.
And finally, as we teased before the break, welcome back to the much beloved goodbye to you / comings and goings segment. And there are a lot of those to cover this week.
Yes, indeed. First up, President Biden is preparing to nominate Tucson Police Chief Chris Magnus to be Commissioner of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Magnus is an outspoken critic of the former guy's immigration policies and how he'll run the country's largest federal law enforcement agency as it contends with the biggest increase in migrants arriving at the southwest border in 2 decades. Although I question that. This seems like a regular seasonal influx to me, but it may be too early to speak on that. But just looking at numbers and math, it seems to be this is a typical seasonal influx.
Yeah. I think you're right to say that, you know, the jury is out on that. Look, Magnus, that's an awesome name. But Magnus is also, he is a Biden kind of pick in the best possible way, right? Like, so here is somebody who has led Tucson, Arizona, right? Like, he's led the Tucson Police Department, right? Like, this is not somebody that you can tar as, you know, an Antifa Black Lives Matter protester, right? But he's been in that job since 2016 and has consistently endorsed policies and practices favored by the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, right? That emphasize community-based policing, less military hardware, less aggression. He has generally been on the side of not cooperating with federal immigration authorities in terms of voluntarily turning over information and cooperating with ICE stings. So look, like, that's all really, really good stuff.
Yes. The only blemish on his progressive record seems to be that Magnus declined to support efforts to make Tucson a sanctuary city. But basically that means one that completely prohibits agreements whereby ICE deputizes local law enforcement officers and to enforce federal immigration laws. So he didn't, and was, I believe, actually spoke out against having Tucson be a sanctuary city.
He did. So let's acknowledge and put that in context. So the statute that's at issue here is 8 U.S.C. section 1357, subsection G, which says that the attorney general may enter into a written agreement with a state or a subdivision, a county or city, and take an officer or officers that the AG thinks is qualified to perform the functions of an immigration officer, quote, in relation to the investigation, apprehension, or detention of aliens, right? So in English, AG can say, hey, let's deputize your local cops to go help us, you know, bust some aliens, right? But the key part of that is, right, written agreement. The locality has to agree, okay? So a sanctuary city is one that says in advance, don't ask. We're never going to agree to this. We're never going to voluntarily turn over our locally gathered data to CBP, right? Like, just go the hell away, don't ask. Magnus's position is not don't ask. It is we will entertain these requests on a case by case basis. But I have to tell you, I cannot find, and I looked, right? Like, you know, I'm not shy about, you know, landing a couple punches here if we have to. I cannot find a single example of Tucson cooperating with ICE raids, allowing its local Tucson cops to be deputized by ICE, planning secret raids. And look, like, you know, we've had secret ICE raids in New York City, right? I mean, you know, this is not that's a pretty good record. I'm pretty impressed.
Yeah, and Tucson would be a place to target if you were going to do that.
Yeah.
What's good? Well, Magnus would also be the first openly gay Customs and Border Protection commissioner. He's been outspoken against police abuse of force. He was among the law enforcement leaders to publicly come out against Derek Chauvin, calling what he did indefensible. And when it was discovered a few weeks later that his own Tucson officers restrained a suspect who died in their custody, Magnus offered to step down from the job to show his willingness to take accountability for these mistakes. The city manager rejected his request, and he remains on the job to this stay, but he offered to tender his resignation.
Yeah. So, look, let's give a warm welcome to Chris Magnus. He replaces acting commissioner Troy Miller, seemed to be just a lifelong staffer at CBP, who in turn replaced Mark Morgan, the last in a series of goddamn monsters who were appointed acting commissioners by the other guy. Morgan, you might recall, made up a bunch of complete nonsense about a second migrant caravan movement forming in Honduras that he went on Fox News on January 8th to scare us all. Now, I wonder why he might have made that up 2 days after the insurrection at the Capitol.
Pivot,
yeah.
pivot. Blame the immigrants, blame the immigrants. And yeah, that's, well, bye-bye. Anyway.
Adios.
Well, yes, welcome to him. Yeah. But Magnus is one of six intended Department of Homeland Security nominees. The Biden administration announced today, on Monday, as we record this show, Monday, April 12th. Biden will also nominate Urja Doe, the former general counsel of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, to lead the agency, which is responsible for running the country's legal immigration system, which hopefully we will have back because former guy pretty much destroyed legal immigration as well.
Yeah. So, hearty welcome to Mr. Jadot. And if you're wondering what kind of nominee this is, I refer you to his Twitter feed in June of 2020, in which he said, quote, "It's time for Congress to save USCIS," that's U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the branch he will now lead, "from the Trump administration, who has driven USCIS into the ground with xenophobic policies that bankrupted the agency, leaving it woefully unprepared to ride out the fiscal impact of the COVID-19 pandemic." So, you know, it's not often you get to run the organization that you tweet about Trump mismanaging. I like it, and I think that means you and I get to be department heads real
noteworthy,
soon. So.
Noteworthy. Other nominees today include John Mayer, or Meyer, excuse me, former DHS and Justice Department attorney. He's going to be the DHS general counsel. And John Tien, a National Security Council advisor to Obama, and he's going to be the deputy DHS secretary. They are all PAS appointees, so they will require the advice and consent of the Senate to be appointed. Right.
Yep.
So now the Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security, Alex Mayorkas, called them extraordinary picks that might hurt these nominees in terms of getting Republican votes. What do you think?
Yeah, you may be right. So Mayorkas, such a great pick, confirmed by the Senate as the first Latino director of Homeland Security by 56-43 vote back in January. So that's 43 garbage Republicans voting no. Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania not voting. And then yays from some of our usual suspects: Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, Rob Portman, kind of odd in Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia, and a nice yes vote from Dan Sullivan of Alaska. So I just want to be in on the ground floor on the maybe purpling of Alaska.
Yes, please.
Give me more of that.
And in what is sure to anger some folks, but is completely meaningless, Joe Biden has prepared to name Cindy McCain as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations World Food Program. Now, multiple sources have confirmed that McCain is undergoing a background check. Good. The Biden administration is set to announce most of its ambassadors at the same time in the next few days. Her appointment would follow a tradition observed by former Presidents Obama, George W. Bush, and Clinton of nominating at least one person from the opposing party to a cabinet position. Trump, of course, broke that tradition. she's going to be nominated as the UN World Food Program Ambassador, Cindy McCain.
Yeah, I can feel the like collective neck hair of our listeners bristling up. I am on team perpetual warfare as much as anybody. This is really a no-brainer, right? Like, the McCains are beloved in Arizona. They endorse Biden. He won by 10,457 votes. When your win is that close, literally every single thing you did in the campaign was key to winning, including campaigning with Cindy and Meghan McCain, right? We have seen this coming for a long time, right? It was reported back in November of 2020 that Biden was eyeing McCain for an ambassadorship. At the time, Politico said maybe ambassador to the United Kingdom. Turns out that's probably going to be a lot of specific work to be done, more so than usual, right? Like, usually that seems like a let's hang out in London and, you know, drink a lot of gin and tonics, but a busy position. McCain was on Biden's transition team advisory board. She spoke at the DNC. This is fine. Right. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Relax.
She's a Democrat. She's a Democrat. Just it's fine. And this was cool news, too. Welcome back to the POW MIA flag that had been taken down by the former guy. That's flying again. Speaking of the McCains, I should say, above the White House. Now, I think that's why he took it down. Honestly, was his beef with McCain, and especially that vote, you know, on repealing Obamacare.
Yeah, the POW MIA flag not associated with the most liberal elements of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and so. Again, to credit the administration for finding a job that actually reflects McCain's actual talents. Mm-hmm. Politico, who broke this story, noted that Cindy McCain has a history of working on programs to combat food insecurity and has previously worked with the UN World Food Program. During the McCain 2008 presidential campaign, she traveled to the country of Georgia with the UN World Food Program and visited wounded soldiers there. So she does actually got a little bit of experience, which is, you know, more we can say for Rick Grinnell or Ratcliffe or any of the other DNIs at the ODNI that we've had to deal with, and you know, so I'm okay with this.
Yeah,
tentative hello to you, Cindy McCain.
Yeah, absolutely. Hello. If you could get your daughter to say some less stupid shit, that would help.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
But welcome aboard.
I am all for advocating that a Charlotte Clymer take Meghan McCain's spot on The View. I'm just throwing that out
love
there.
Love that.
I know Charlotte's into it, so if anybody feels like tweeting that out, or, you know, if you know anybody who works on The View, I think that she would be an excellent choice.
That would be an outstanding choice. Love it.
Mm. But that's our comings and goings. A lot more comings than goings. Question for you. Any idea when we're going to see U.S. attorneys?
I've been waiting with bated breath. I keep checking the page, looking for it.
Right, because we got a 2022 statute of limitations on these obstruction of justice charges that could be brought against Trump in the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office.
We need bodies. This question actually came up during the post trivia party that we had, and somebody basically said it was a non U.S. listener had some really nice words for you, tolerable words for me, listens to the show, and said, well, when are we going to get, you know, all of these indictments of, you know, Trump and Trump Org and Trump organization, Trump administration officials. I shared that frustration. I said, look, the best guess that I can give you right now is sort of twofold. Like, number one, all hands are on deck at the DOJ regarding insurrection prosecutions, right? Like, coordinating 500 different defendants. That's a lot, and that's a minefield, right? Like, if they did what you typically did, you know, would do, which would be settle out 497 of those, I think, yeah, you'd have outrage, right? Like, people would be up in arms, and rightly so. So that's my excuse making for DOJ. But I'm with you, right? Like, the clock is ticking, and it's time to, you know, show us that you're committed to cleaning up aisle 45. So,
and it's not like Merrick Garland who has to do all that stuff. It's the senators, right, or delegates from each state or territory that interview those particular candidates and then make their recommendations. I mean, there's a process. It's not like that.
No, sorry, that you. Let me clarify, because I realized that. I didn't quite say an assumption, right? So that's not a reason not to have U.S. attorneys. The fact that they are understaffed is an additional reason to think that some of these prosecutions have not gone forward, right?
But that you know, they're focused elsewhere, and we still don't have our U.S. attorneys for this administration. So I wouldn't look for somebody like Tim Shea or Sherwin, who is now, I guess, back in Miami. I don't even know who's at the D.C. Oh, it's the acting. Okay, yeah, through the Vacancies Act stuff. But like, it's so short staff. We don't have our new appointees. But, you know, fear not. Those obstruction of justice charges happened. He committed that criminal behavior, I should say. He engaged in that criminal behavior in 2017. That gives us till 2022. We can do it. We can do it. I'm all for it.
Me too.
And then one final question. If anyone can answer this for me, just hit us up on Twitter, at Aisle45Pod, AISLE45POD. How long does it take to get a drug like the vaccines off of emergency use authorization and into regular authorization, because half of our military is refusing to take these shots, and it's because it's on emergency use authorization. They can't require them until they are off emergency use authorization. And I was just wondering how long that takes, if anybody knows when that's going to be. Because when I was in the military, I didn't get a fucking choice. I don't want these motherfuckers to be able to choose either. Sorry, that's what you get for signing up.
I did not know that story, that it is not being reported elsewhere. So I'm really glad that you brought that out.
Yeah, no problem at all. So if anybody knows the answer to that, hit us up on Twitter at Aisle45Pod. And that is all we've got for you this week. It was a very long show. We had a lot of stuff to cover, but I'm so glad that you were here. And Andrew, I absolutely love doing this with you. So thank you very much.
Highlight of my week, AG. Love it. And let's keep doing it.
Yeah. And we'll see you all Tuesday on the Stereo app at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, where we're going to do our little live meet and greet if you want to talk to us. So stick around for that. That'll be cool.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Have a good one. Thanks.
Cleanup on Aisle 45 is written and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres and is engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mizell and Starburns Audio. Fact-checking and research by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres, with quality assurance and media by Muller She Wrote LLC. Branding, design, and logo by Starburns Audio and Joel Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. And our copy is written by Jesse Egan. Our music is written and recorded by Adam Orr and Christopher Hoffey, and our opening sequence was designed by Allison Gill and mixed by Mackenzie Mizell and Starburns Audio. Follow us on Twitter at Aisle45Pod and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Season 4 of How We Win is here.
For the past 4 years, we've been making history in critical elections all over the country. And last year, we made history again by expanding our majority in the Senate, beating election-denying Republicans in crucial state House races, and fighting back a non-existent red wave.
But the MAGA Republicans who plotted and pardoned the attempted overthrow of our government now control the House, thanks to gerrymandered maps and repressive anti-voter laws. And the chaotic spectacle we've already seen shows us just how far they will go to seize power, dismantle our government, and take away our freedoms.
So the official podcast of The Persistence is back with season 4. There's so much more important work ahead of us to fight for equity, justice, and our very democracy itself. We'll take you behind the lines and inside the rooms where it happens, with strategy and inspiration from progressive changemakers all over the country.
And we'll dig deep into the weekly news that matters most and what you can do about it, with messaging and communications expert, co-founder of Way to Win, and our new co-host, Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
So join Steve and I every Wednesday for your weekly dose of inspiration, action, and hope.
I'm Steve Pearson.
And I'm Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
And this is How We Win.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, It's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times. And stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in. But you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.